stun grenades on a load-bearing vest he'd thrown on over his polo. He winked when he'd handed Carr an MP5. I believe in all the force multipliers I can get. Your boss said you're good for this. The ambassador was more than a little grouchy when he'd not been given a gun as well, but he got over it quickly. Gizzard told both men to grab some much-needed rest. Their orders, the team leader said, were to sit tight and wait. It seemed like seconds later when Carr's eyes flicked open to Gizzard's gloved hand on his shoulder. We're about to go kinetic, he said. Wait for the signal. What's the signal? Burlingame asked. Both Carr and Burlingame couldn't suppress their smiles when Gizzard explained. Carr took up a position behind the rusted semi-trailer while two teams of four men, including Gizzard, flanked the door to the warehouse. The remaining four set up at cardinal points, facing outbound to pull security. The kidnappers, apparently feeling safely ensconced inside their own country, had neglected to check outside even once. 3 minutes after the D-boys had taken their positions, the warehouse door opened a crack, and one of the kidnappers, the most junior from the looks of him, poked his head out. He was just 2 feet from Gizzard, who stood on the other side of a small extension of the entryway. Had the man come out another inch, Gizzard could have reached out and touched him. Instead, the kidnapper took a cursory look as if he was expecting something. Completely oblivious to the presence of the nearby Americans, he sniffed the air a moment and then ducked back inside. 30 seconds later, the air shook with a tremendous roar. The ground, the trees, the warehouse itself trembled as 4 FA-18 fighter jets ripped overhead in a finger-four formation, turkey feather exhaust nozzles open. They flew just 500 feet off the deck at 690 miles per hour. Almost, but not quite the speed of sound. Breaking the sound barrier at that altitude would have shattered windows, but a sonic boom would have been too quick. The pilots wanted to maximize the duration of their engine noise. Carr knew it was coming, and he still jumped. Watching, hearing the four jets scream overhead, seeming close enough to touch, was the epitome of shock and awe. 3 of the kidnappers rushed outside to investigate the terrifying noise. Bald Spot remained inside. Gizzard gave the one in the lead a rabbit punch in the back of the neck, grabbing him by the shoulder to swing him around and to the ground, like a matador's cape. The next 2 Cameroonian soldiers in line received similar treatment and were face down and flex-cuffed before they had time to cry out. Gizzard pointed a knife hand at the semi-trailer where Carr and Burlingame were positioned and motioned them forward. The ambassador stayed on Carr's tail as he crossed the 30 feet of open ground to the corner of the warehouse. Gizzard held up a small tablet computer strapped to his forearm, showing the video feed from inside. Bald Spot had left his weapon against the wall and now paced in front of Mrs. Porter. It was a simple matter for 3 of the D-boys to breach the door, plow the hapless soldier to the dirt floor. Carr heard one of the men inside shout, U.S. Army! We're here to get you out, Mrs. Porter. Gizzard gave Carr a nod. It'll be less traumatic for her if someone she knows removes her hood. Carr and Ambassador Burlingame rushed inside. Sarah, Burlingame said, it's me, Chance. Mr. Ambassador, she said from beneath the hood. Her chest finally gave way to sobs. Burlingame gently lifted away the hood. Carr's jaw convulsed when the cloth came off to reveal an ugly black bruise under Mrs. Porter's left eye. The DS agent wheeled on the downed kidnapper, kicking the man hard in the ribs, rolling him so he was face up. You bastard, Carr screamed, falling on top of the man and pummeling his face with blow after blow. He expected one of the D-boys to pull him off. No one did, so he kept hitting until he got tired, and he was in better than average shape. You cannot do this, Bald Spot whimpered when Carr finally let up. You will be arrested. Carr hit the man one more time. Nope, he said. Pretty sure I've got diplomatic immunity. Sean Jolivet had once heard a quote from a Lockheed Skunk Works engineer to SR-71 pilots that a sloppy turn started in Atlanta could put the airplane over Chattanooga by the time it was complete. At speeds of Mach 1.7, the Hornet was roughly half as fast as the venerable Blackbird, But it still required a fair amount of finesse to turn. Jolivet bled off speed as soon as he passed over the warehouse coordinates, slowing to best cornering velocity of 330 knots. He tensed the muscles against his thighs and gut in the so-called Hick maneuver, keeping blood flowing to his brain as he took the Hornet into a 180-degree horizontal turn, pulling nearly 7.5 Gs and eating up a hell of a lot of real estate over the ground. Any more Gs and he risked making the guys in maintenance mad when he broke the airplane. Pouring on throttle, the strike fighters overflew the warehouse once again. Unaware of how things were going on the ground, all four of them repeated the horizontal turn and pointed their noses toward the presidential residence, dropping even lower this time to do it all again. N'Jaya was apoplectic. "You are attacking us!" As if by magic, Ryan switched to his calmer, more diplomatic self. "What are you talking about, Francois? My people are there to help you regain control. If the hostages go free unharmed, we can stand down. All this will be forgiven. Though I must caution, it will not be forgotten." "And the money?" N'Jaya asked. "Oh, we'll get that all sorted," Ryan said. "I'm sure the accounts will be unfrozen as soon as every American is released and your troops pull back from the embassy. You can see to the men who have committed these crimes as you see fit." N'Jaya gulped. "I will make certain the men who now surround your embassy depart at once." "That is all I can ask," Ryan said. "But what of Mbida?" "He'll be given safe passage out of the country." There was a long pause on the line. Ryan and the others in the room couldn't help but smile when it was filled with the booming roar of jets overhead. "I see," N'Jaya stammered. "But, Mr. President, this entire incident has cost me politically. I am begging you, do not send your troops into my country. It would make me appear to be weak." Ryan's voice grew dark again. He spoke clearly and slowly. "You misunderstand the situation, Francois. I am not going to send in anyone. They are already there, overhead, in your shops, on your highways, behind every building and tree. They are embedded with your rapid response soldiers, whom they have worked alongside against Boko Haram for years." More silence. Ryan got a thumbs up from Burgess that Mrs. Porter was free and safe. "Very well," he said. "If I can be of any further assistance, please let me know." He disconnected before N'Jaya could respond. Exhausted, Ryan waited in the Situation Room long enough to hear that the Cameroonian troops were pulling back from the embassy. He said goodnight, knowing the morning alarm was going to come before he knew it, and he made a quick stop by the Oval to grab some papers he wanted to read the next morning before coming in. Standing behind his desk, he stretched, then looked at his watch. He awoke so frequently in different places around the globe that his circadian clock was in constant reset mode. He only paid attention to the time anymore, so he wouldn't inconvenience too many others. Darren Huang, the Secret Service night shift supervisor, a kid about Jack Jr.'s age, stood outside the door of the Oval Office, waiting to walk him to the residence. Ryan motioned for him to step inside. "What can I do for you, Mr. President?" "Hey, Darren," Ryan said. "Still pitching on Saturday?" Ryan liked to know just a little bit about each of the agents who protected him. Huang was team captain and pitcher on an adult league baseball team where he lived in Great Falls, Virginia. The agent didn't have the need to know, but two of the other members of his team were case officers at CIA. One of them happened to be Mary Pat Foley's nephew. It was the way of things in D.C. You either were a spy or knew someone who was, even if you didn't know you knew it. The agent smiled at his boss. "Indeed I am, sir. We're starting off to a pretty good year." "Good to hear," Ryan said. "I'm going to gather up a few things and hit the head, then I'll be ready. Would you do me a favor and let Special Agent in Charge Montgomery know that I need to talk to him first thing?" "Understood, Mr. President," Huang said. He stepped outside and shut the door behind him, assuming his panther-like gaze outward toward any oncoming threat. Unbeknownst to Ryan, the agent pushed the button at the end of the wire that ran down his sleeve, and then spoke into his lapel mic to Crown, Secret Service code for the White House command post, letting the uniformed division desk officer know that Swordsman wanted to speak with the SAIC. Ryan had time to get rid of his last two cups of coffee and flush the toilet before his personal cell phone rang. He let it ring while he washed his hands. "Jack Ryan," he said, shoving the phone between his ear and shoulder while he dried. "Good evening, Mr. President." Shit. He'd woken up Gary Montgomery when he didn't need to. "My fault, Gary. I meant first thing tomorrow." "No worries," the special agent in charge said, stifling a yawn. "I can be right there." No, Ryan said. "Please, we can talk about it tomorrow." There was silence for a moment. Then, "Your call, sir, but to be honest, if it's something important, I'd rather get a jump on it." Ryan thought about that, nodding to himself. He was the same way. "I have a special assignment I'd like to run by you. It's a delicate matter, the kind that could end a career. And I have to admit, this one is very likely to blow up in both our faces." "Put it that way, Mr. President," Montgomery said, "I'm in 100%. "Good," Ryan said. "I'll give you a 5-minute rundown of what I have in mind, then we can hash out the details when I see you first thing. Tomorrow." Chapter 33 Eric Dovzhenko did a little shopping at the Dubai airport before he headed over to the relatively run-down Terminal 2 so he could catch his Ariana connection to Kabul. He had just over an hour, enough time to grab a few necessities like ibuprofen, Imodium, and Vicks cough drops. Military logisticians, even the notoriously stoic Russian army, ensured that their soldiers had access to what the Americans referred to as bullets, beans, and band-aids. But intelligence officers, especially those on the run, had to provide for themselves. In addition to his meager first aid supplies, Dovzhenko purchased 2 stainless steel 1-liter water bottles, a blue baseball cap with no logo, which was surprisingly difficult to find, and a flimsy-looking duffel bag in an earthen brown color. It was supposed to be military-grade, but had far too many straps and loading points that Dovzhenko would eventually have to cut off as soon as he reached a spot outside airport security where he could get a knife. He still wasn't hungry, but he bought a couple Snickers bars, knowing he'd eventually need the energy. He filled the 2 bottles from a water fountain and made it to the gate just in time to make his connection. The inexpensive Vostok Amphibia on his wrist couldn't be hawked to bail him out of a tight spot like the fancy dive watches spies wore in the movies. But it was built like a tank and was acceptably accurate. His diplomatic passport, a pair of sunglasses, 2 ballpoint pens, and Mariam's notebook rounded out his entire loadout of gear. It had always galled him that American currency was so ubiquitous where the ruble was not. But one did what was necessary, and he customarily carried $2,000 divided between his belt and the lining of his leather jacket. He'd changed some of it into the local Afghani currency when he arrived at Kabul, but American $20 bills would speak with a much louder voice. A young woman with black bangs peeking from beneath a blue hijab greeted him as he boarded. He stowed the duffel in the overhead, keeping the notebook with him, and wedged himself into his impossibly narrow seat. Fortunately, the plane was only about a third full, so everyone had an entire row to themselves. The greasy smell of lamb warming in the galley oven made him wish he'd taken some of the Imodium. He settled himself in as best he could, put on the sunglasses, and pulled the ball cap down low. Exhaustion overtook him, and he was asleep before the landing gear came up, dreaming of Mariam's face. Ghostly pale, one eye open even in death, as if to be certain he'd made it to safety. Chapter 34 The Afghan customs official at the Kabul airport was a stumpy, heavy-set man who looked as if he could not quite commit to growing a beard. He eyed Dovzhenko's diplomatic passport suspiciously, then shunted him off to a supervisor. The second man did not appear to like Russians any more than the first, but waved him into the country nonetheless. The airport was small and the layover was quick, just long enough for Dovzhenko's clothing to soak up the odor of dust and burning garbage that would accompany him for the rest of his time in Afghanistan. He exchanged $200 for just under 15,000 Afghanis, about a third of a month's pay for the average Afghan man. Half an hour later, he was in the air again, flying over mountains that were the same color as his new duffel. There was one attendant on the Ariana flight to Herat. Unlike the young woman out of Dubai, this one kept her bangs tucked neatly inside her blue hijab. Anguish and fatigue consumed a great many calories, and Dovzhenko was feeling unsteady on his feet by the time he landed in Herat. Pilots in Afghanistan had gotten used to rapid corkscrew descents to keep from getting shot. Even now, when the danger was minimal around Herat province, landings were white-knuckle, ear-popping affairs. The warm naan bread and spiced lamb wraps from the stall outside the terminal caused him to salivate, but he opted for one of his candy bars instead. It was a little too early to be breaking into the Imodium. The sugar seemed to go straight to his cells, and though he felt no happier, he could at least walk in a straight line without looking as though he might keel over. He used the renewed energy to scan the outer terminal for danger. Dovzhenko had spent enough time in dangerous places to know the threats in this place would come from every direction. Former enemies might act like friends one moment, and then revert to old habits if some unanswered insult popped into their minds. A clear head was essential to survival now. There could be no more losing himself to his grief. His mother had often told him the Tolstoy story about a peasant who went to steal cucumbers from his neighbor's farm. This cucumber thief became so engrossed in thoughts of becoming wealthy from planting the seeds of the stolen loot that he began to daydream others were stealing from him, and absent-mindedly shouted to his imaginary guards, "Keep an eye out for thieves," alerting the real guards. It was his mother's favorite story, and she told it every time she thought Dovzhenko had his head in the clouds. A spy, she said, could not afford to daydream. In Afghanistan, she was surely right. Herat was one of the safer cities in the country, which was to say that one might expect to get blown to pieces by an unexploded cluster bomb, or be murdered by common criminals instead of having your body torn apart by a blast from a suicide bomber. Though that was always a possibility as well. The Taliban generally kept their business to other parts of the country. Around here, that was to the south, in the scrub-filled wadis below Shindand, and to the east, where they smuggled opium across the border with Iran. At least, that's where they'd been when it had been his job to provide them with Russian Kalashnikovs and F-1 hand grenades. Dovzhenko's taxi driver was somewhere in his early 30s, with the look of a man who had once been muscular and fit, but was now muscular and fat. He spoke of politics, the way everyone in Afghanistan talked about such things after half a century of occupation and war. The ride into Herat would have cost around $8. Dovzhenko offered the man 20 to take him through the city itself, and then another 5 kilometers east through fields of saffron crocus and pistachio trees to the dusty village of Jebrail. The driver kept to the back roads rather than the highway, admitting that the headquarters for his old unit of the Afghan National Army was along the highway. Dovzhenko didn't ask about the bad blood, but it was enough to make the driver spit on the floor when he mentioned the 4th Armored Brigade. The driver was familiar with the address for the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, and though he appeared to have almost as much bad blood for Russians as he did for his former employer, he took Dovzhenko to the dusty yellow building on the edge of town. The wind was blowing steadily by the time they arrived, sandblasting Dovzhenko's skin and nearly ripping the money out of his hand as he stepped out of the vehicle. The driver snatched away the 20 and headed back the way he'd come, without another word. In front of the building, a boy of 12 or 13 wearing shalwar kameez, the loose pajama-like pants and long shirt ubiquitous in Afghanistan, leaned against the wall with his little sister under the swinging wood UNODC sign. They squinted at the new foreigner in the stiff wind. A moment later, A woman in a black chador came out the door and said something to the children. She shooed them past Dovzhenko, her head down. The little girl looked up at him with green eyes and smiled. Dovzhenko shouldered his duffel and walked inside. The wooden desk in the sparse front room was clean and neat, with a single manila folder in the center. A cup of tea sat on a clay coaster beside it, half full, as if someone had just walked away. A rotating rack full of pamphlets about farming and drug addiction was the only other furniture. The wind blew the door shut behind him with a loud crack, causing him to drop the duffel and spin instinctively. He released a pent-up sigh, cursing this awful wind. The sound of a man's voice carried in from somewhere in the back, gruff and confrontational. Dovzhenko opened his mouth to call out, but thought better of it. More voices, angrier now, then the muffled cry of a woman and the clatter of furniture. Hackles up. Dovzhenko stepped past the desk and down a dark hallway. His hand went instinctively for the Makarov, reaching inside his jacket pocket before he remembered the pistol wasn't there. Rounding the corner into a concrete storage room, he found two men leaning over the figure of a woman. The men blocked Dovzhenko's view, but he could see a dark blue headscarf. One of the men shoved her against some metal shelving, earning himself a slap to his ear. The other cuffed her hard in the neck, earning himself a kick to the groin. Dovzhenko gave a shrill whistle, advancing in two bounding steps and headbutting the nearest man in the nose the moment he turned. A second man, with a thick beard dyed gaudily red, swung at him wildly, a massive fist whirring by the Russian's temple, missing by a fraction of an inch. Dovzhenko gave the man he'd just headbutted a donkey kick to the side of the knee, buying himself a little time. He used the momentum of a spin to plant an elbow across Redbeard's face. The big Afghan fell flat on his back. Dovzhenko kicked him hard, once in the neck and once in the side of the head. Redbeard was out, but his partner was still upright. He hobbled on one leg, spraying bloody mist out the gash of burst skin on the bridge of his nose with each exhaled breath. His chin was up, attempting to stanch the flow. Dovzhenko punched him hard in the throat and then caught him by the face with an open palm, driving up and over, slamming him to the concrete floor. The Afghan's eyes rolled, showing their whites. The spray of blood from his nose slowed to gurgling bubbles. Both men were surely concussed. They might even have cracked skulls, but Dovzhenko did not care. Enraged from the fight, he grabbed the man by the ears, bashing his head against the floor over and over and over. These men had attacked Mariam. Dovzhenko shook his head. No, that wasn't right. Isabel. They'd attacked Isabel. He turned to check on her at the same moment a dark blur flew at him. Something heavy hit hard in his chest, driving him backward. Hands in front to ward off another attack, he looked down to see a dagger sticking straight out from his leather jacket. Screeching like she was insane, Isabel dropped to the ground, sweeping sideways with powerful legs. Dovzhenko fell, landing beside Redbeard, wondering why the dagger blade didn't hurt more than it did. He yanked it out as he rolled, attempting to evade the woman's lashing feet that seemed bent on caving in his skull. Dovzhenko had been kicked before by people who knew very well how to kick. Instead of rolling away, he rolled toward her, trapping the lead foot as it plowed into him. He kept rolling, leverage from the weight of his body slamming her backward. She hit the ground with a sickening thud. She tried to scream, but managed nothing but a croak. It was only then, her diaphragm too paralyzed to draw a breath, that she remained still long enough for Dovzhenko to get a good look at her. Long black hair spilled from a blue hijab. Ebony eyes stared up at him over prominent cheekbones. Her nose wasn't too large, though she probably thought it so, and it had a slight hook to it. The most remarkable feature about her was the scars. With the scarf pulled away, he could see many on the bronze skin of her neck. They were not ugly. Far from it. A fine white line to the right of a perfect Cupid's bow gave her lips a perpetual pout. The rest simply added to the smoldering intensity of her demeanor. Dovzhenko remembered the dagger and kicked it out of her reach, his hand searching for the wound under his leather jacket. "You could have killed me," he said, withdrawing Mariam's notebook, panting. The tip of the blade had nicked his bottom rib, but the cardboard and leather cover had prevented it from reaching his heart. He wasn't bleeding badly, at least not that he could see. My auntie telephoned to say that a Russian was looking for me. Her English was perfect, almost, but not quite British. I never told her I was Russian, Dovzhenko said. Your auntie has a good ear. The aggressive phone call had at least put her on guard, if it had almost cost him his life. What are you doing with Mariam's book? Dovzhenko closed his eyes. I am afraid I bring bad news. Mariam... The back door creaked open, letting in a howl of wind. Dovzhenko opened his eyes to find a large Afghan standing on the threshold, the wind whipping the shamag tied around his neck. The new arrival took a quick scan of the unconscious Afghans on the floor, and then shot a glance at Isabel. She held up her hand. I am fine, Hamid. His gaze then fell to Dovzhenko. The Afghan's hair was cut close to the scalp, but he had a long black beard, groomed to a great scimitar of a point. Smile lines creased his cheeks and eyes, a rarity in a country that had suffered generations of war. His wide leather belt held a pistol and long knife. A Kalashnikov hung from his neck on a three-point sling, with the release tab pulled and the rifle pointed directly at Dovzhenko's chest. The fact that he carried a rifle was not surprising. But a relatively sophisticated tactical sling in a country where many carried their weapons on a length of old carpeting or a piece of rope made Dovzhenko think he might know how to use the thing. He had to be former military. But virtually every fighting-age male had fought on one side or another of one battle or another over the past four decades, so that wasn't much of a leap. Hamid smoothed the point of his long beard.
The generator is fixed, he said.
They must have damaged it to draw me outside. He motioned for Isabel to step out of the way. It was clear that she was the employer, but he was in charge of her safety. He focused on Dovzhenko now. What is your business? The man asked in Dari, eyes squinting from the gritty wind that now swirled around the storeroom. Dovzhenko got to his feet and squinted back, but didn't answer. What do you want? Hamid asked again, in English this time. I am here to see Ms. Kashani. Hamid cocked his head to the side. You are a Ruski? I am, Dovzhenko said, staying with English. He raised his hands. You should go now. Dovzhenko took a deep breath. I cannot do that. Sand and dust roared outside behind the Afghan, giving him another worldly look. Isabel spoke now. He has my friend's notebook. She glared at Dovzhenko with narrow eyes, black as liquid tar. How did you get it? When he told her Mariam's story, Isabel Kashani fell to her knees and wept. Chapter 35 The couch in Major Sassani's office was more comfortable than his bed at home, chiefly because he did not have a nagging woman sharing the other half of it. His wife, Freya, had once been beautiful, if never kind. Now she was neither. Her father was a general in the corps, which meant Sassani had to keep her reasonably satisfied. But even the general knew his daughter was a shrew. So long as Sassani did not get caught doing anything that would bring dishonor on the family, and thus the general's good name, there was no need to go overboard with kindness or, for that matter, to speak to her at all. She, of course, reciprocated, so Sassani often found himself sleeping on the couch in his office these days. Sassani had driven to Dovzhenko's apartment after his visit to the morgue and talked to the man he had stationed there. The Russian had yet to return, but he would come home to roost soon enough. Sassani toyed with the idea of accusing the SVR man directly, imagining the delicious flash of fear, the babbling reply of the guilty. Dovzhenko looked down on him, considered him an animal for using techniques that the Russians could no longer stomach. The man's utter contempt for the way Sassani did business was plain in his eyes. Sassani woke from a dreamless sleep to the sound of people already at work in the bullpen outside his office. His men knew he kept odd hours, and unless the general was going to pay them a visit, they let him sleep until he woke up naturally. 6 hours was about as long as he could take on the couch. He stretched, and then rolled to the floor for 30 push-ups. He cheated on the last 8, but the curtains to his office were drawn, so it did not matter. Half-hearted push-ups were better than no push-ups at all. He opened the curtains and then took a few moments to face east and pray. The piety of a good leader clearly demonstrated, Sasani sat behind his desk to plan his day. He wanted desperately to spend every moment following leads in connection to Mariam Farhad, and by extension, the Russian. She was, or had been, up to her slender little neck in this treachery against the regime. He wanted to track down her friend, the one who'd loaned her the apartment. He looked at his notebook. Isabella Kashani, that was it. But he knew better than to focus too much of his effort on a single case. This Reza Kazem was a snake and charlatan, wooing tens of thousands with his wickedness. For some reason, the Ayatollah did not want him taken into custody quite yet. It made some degree of sense to use the man as bait to see who committed open rebellion for his cause. Sasani did not say it, but he wondered how many would rebel if Kazem simply disappeared. There were plenty of traitors to deal with. The list of demonstrators identified at the most recent hangings numbered in the hundreds and would only grow as security footage was reviewed. He and his men would begin working on that after lunch, after they'd done complete and careful backgrounds on each known individual. Depending on their family connections and the circles in which they ran, some would be interviewed and given strong warnings to bring their behavior in line with the regime. Others, who had no influential fathers or uncles within their Daura circles, would be used as examples to the others. There were, after all, at least 3 empty hooks on the ceiling of Evin prison. Sasani had just removed the small shaving kit from his desk drawer when his phone rang. He snatched up the handset.
Bali. Major.
It was a female voice. Dr. Nuri, Sasani said, I expected your call some time ago.
Rubbish, Nuri said. I told you it would be at least 12 hours, and it has been far less than that.
Managing expectations, Sasani said. A wise move on your part.
Nothing of the sort. Do you wish the preliminary results via email or fax?
Email is fine. He looked at his watch. Tell me what you found.
Your unknown subject is likely Azeri. That is useless. Sasani's hopes fell. A quarter of this city is Azeri.
If you would let me finish, Nuri said. The man you are looking for is likely of mixed heritage, Azeri and Slavic, Eastern European.
A Russian. DNA can give you ethnicity, not nationality. But he could be Russian.
Yes, he could. Nuri groaned.
That is what I said, Slavic. If you have a DNA sample from someone in particular, I can run it and do a comparison. Hair, saliva. Something like that would work.
Thank you, doctor, he said, forgetting for the time being that he hated her. He replaced the handset and then picked it up again, ordering the man posted at Dovzhenko's apartment to break in and get a sample of anything with his DNA on it, and then run it to the morgue. The major was smiling when he slid a green file folder to the center of his desk and printed Isabel Kashani in block letters on the tab. Her social media accounts showed her to be in London. He'd have one of his men stationed there check it out. Next, he completed the appropriate form for a full background and immediate pickup order. He toyed with the idea of calling Dovzhenko's superiors at the Russian embassy, but then decided against it. The last thing he wanted was for the Russians to whisk their spy back to Moscow. Dovzhenko deserved more than some administrative punishment. So much more. Sasani would make certain he was the one to give it to him.
Chapter 36.
Vadek Cherenko excused himself to retrieve something from his room and told his men to oversee the transfer of a dozen wooden crates from the nose door of the Antonov 124 to the waiting Ilyushin 76. The Omani base commander believed they were smuggling antiquities, so it was important that he saw antiquities moving from plane to plane. The missiles would be easily identified, so they were simply left in place, and then the entire airplane turned over to the crew that had arrived on the Ilyushin. Cherenko could have flown the new plane, but told his superiors he would be more comfortable with another pilot who was more familiar with that particular airframe. He'd known from the moment he'd been ordered to kill Colonel Mikhailov that this operation could have no loose ends. There was someone out there, probably having arrived on the Ilyushin, that had orders to take care of him. It was the way of these things. Kill enough people until you reached a killer who knew nothing of the original operation. Only those who had no idea why they were killing might be safe. But Cherenko would take himself out of this equation. He crammed the last of his clothing into a small duffel, listening to the whine of the Antonov's engines, feeling the vibration in the thin walls as the plane turned out onto the taxiway. The Ilyushin would follow it out, but Cherenko would not be on it. The second half of his payment would be deposited in his account once the Antonov was airborne with the missiles and the command control units. Greed, they thought, whoever they were, would keep him in place until they could silence him as well. But Cherenko was only half as greedy as they believed him to be. It was relatively easy to leave behind $500,000, since he'd get a bullet in the ear if he stuck around to see it. He'd already moved the first half of his payment to a new account, unknown to the cretins in GRU. He'd amassed a substantial nest egg, and with it, the first $500,000 gave him plenty to go into semi-retirement in Thailand. He'd pick up a few flying jobs and be set for life. The others were on their own, but they knew the risks. Yuri Zherdev, his communications officer from the Antonov, the one who'd actually put the bullet in Colonel Mikhailov's neck, was in the most danger. He was young, cocky, with little experience as to the duplicitous ways of men. Cherenko had thought to warn him, but decided against it. Comrade Major. Cherenko froze at the sudden voice behind him. He'd not even heard the door open. He turned. Oh, it's you, Yuri, he said, relaxing a notch when he saw his communications officer. Did our prize get off all right?
It did, Zherdev said, bound for Iran.
We cannot be certain of that, Cherenko chided. Russia can have no part in giving nuclear missiles to the Ayatollahs.
And still, Zherdev said, that is exactly what we do.
Cherenko zipped the duffel closed, shaking his head. Have a care, comrade. Do not repeat that to anyone but me. Now please, tell the others I'll be right along. I need to make a quick phone call.
Will you?
Cherenko raised a wary brow. Will I what?
Be right along, the younger man said. It seems as though you have already moved your funds to another account.
How do you know this?
Zherdev sighed. It does not matter.
He took a silenced pistol from behind his back and pointed it at Cherenko's chest.
Wait.
Cherenko's hands flew up in front of him. They will kill us all to keep this secret. You know this. None of us is safe.
Zherdev gave a half-hearted shrug. I believe I am, he said. You too have seen things, Cherenko stammered. That means even you must be silenced.
I do not think so.
You are correct about all the others, but you see, my uncle gave me this assignment. I don't believe his brother, my father in the Politburo, would take kindly to him ending me. That's why I am given the job of ending you.
Cherenko began to pant, slack-jawed.
You?
He could have tried to defend himself, but he was a pilot, not a fighter. Zherdev motioned with the gun for him to turn around.
I am sorry that I do not have any vodka to offer you. I am told it makes this part easier.
Urbano da Rocha set the phone on the nightstand next to his bed and rolled over toward Lucilla, who lay naked in bed beside him. "We will soon be back in our own bed, my love," he said, "such as it is." "Our own bed is fine," Lucilla said. "This is foolishness, and you know it." "Nothing of the sort," the Hosha scoffed. "I sell weapons to factions and governments, sometimes both sides of the same conflict. That is how it is done, my dear. If I start deciding who and who not to sell to, then I would very quickly find myself out of business." "But this cargo is nuclear," Lucilla said. "There is grave danger in that sort of business." Dahosha traced the angle of her collarbone with the tip of his finger. "You've never worried about danger before. Forgive me, but you kill one with relative ease. Killing 1,000 is little different." "Ah," Lucilla said, "but what if we are the ones being killed? It is different then, is it not?" Dahosha gave a contemplative nod. "The Russians need us. I believe they are setting up a pipeline to Iran, using us as a cutout so they will have deniability. You heard them. They are trying us out for future business." Lucilla turned, coming up on one elbow. "How do you know this? I think they told you that to keep us in line. You heard them. They fully expect this route to be burned." "They do," Dahosha said. "And the fact that they told us is a measure of good faith. This route will burn, but we will establish others. The world is a very big place. If Russia wishes to provide Iran with nuclear weapons, they will need a pipeline. 2 missiles will only invite retaliation by the West. Even the Cretans in Tehran know that." Lucilla fell onto her pillow, staring up at the ceiling, her chest heaving. "It is madness." "Necessary madness," Dahosha said. "As we have demonstrated so clearly to the Russians, there is always someone waiting in the wings to fill a void. Had we not provided transport, someone else would have. I see no reason why we should not be the ones to benefit. Don't you see, my love? The profit from this will allow us to undercut our competition on other deals, leaving me the last man standing." "That sounds like a lonely place," Lucilla said. Dahosha caressed a lock of her hair, but gave up trying to convince her of anything. She was deadly and beautiful, but she had no head for business. Chapter 37 Dubchenko left nothing out, including the torture at Evin prison and Sasani eventually hanging the dead boy's body. He described Mariam's death, going into more detail than he needed to, but far less than he still saw when he closed his eyes. He needed her to understand how brutal this man was, to realize that she too was in grave danger. Hamid tied and gagged the 2 Afghans, though they were still unconscious and it was not likely necessary. Afterward, he stood beside Isabel with his rifle hanging down in front of his chest on the sling, twitchy, ready, eyeing Dubchenko. It was beyond unusual to see an Afghan male spending time alone with a woman who was not his wife, especially in ultra-conservative Herat. But Hamid had the feel of someone who put a higher value on duty than decorum. Isabel needed protection, so he protected her, fiercely. The Afghan listened to Dubchenko's story with a disgusted grimace, and then rolled his eyes, clearly not buying any of it. "It seems to me that you have made a long journey," Hamid said, "when a phone call would have sufficed." "Ah, but would it have?" Dubchenko asked. "You do not believe me now. Do you truly believe you would have trusted me over the telephone?" Isabel dabbed at her tears with the hijab, wearing it like a shawl now instead of a headscarf. "So you are the one who called my auntie?"
"I am," Dubchenko said. "I hoped I could frighten her into being wary when the IRGC made contact."
Isabel smoothed the front of her dress with both hands and took a deep breath, composing herself. "One needs no warning to fear the Sepa." Another tear.
certainly not her last, rolled down her cheek. Redbeard groaned in the corner, but remained unconscious. Dovzhenko nodded toward him.
Smugglers?
Yes, Isabel said. You must have passed Fatima on your way in. She traveled 7 kilometers on foot just to warn me that some of the local businessmen are unhappy with UNODC attempting to get more poppy fields turned into saffron crocuses. Isabel sighed, as if this sort of attack happened frequently.
Smugglers are the least of your worries, Dovzhenko said. You have to leave. Go someplace the IRGC will not know to look.
Hamid gave another grunt. I still do not understand what is in this for you. Dovzhenko spoke to Isabel, ignoring the bodyguard.
Sassani will find you here. I am certain of it.
Isabel held up a hand to let him know she'd heard enough. You have to admit how odd it looks that a person who attends torture sessions in Evin prison, a person who stands shoulder to shoulder with the Revolutionary Guard at public executions, would make the journey to Afghanistan to warn a woman whom he has never met.
I told you, Dovzhenko said, he will throw me in prison too. We have a common problem.
I have few friends left in government, Isabel said. But I will return to Iran and straighten it.
Please, Dovzhenko said,
stridently enough to bring Hamid up on his toes. Isabel waved him down, a master telling her attack dog to remain calm. For now. Dovzhenko continued, his passion unchecked.
You must believe me. We have to leave now.
Hamid stepped forward.
We do not have to do anything.
Isabel said, I'm guilty of nothing but being Mariam's friend.
But you will confess to much more, Dovzhenko said. Sassani will make sure of that.
All right, Isabel said. Say, I follow you. Where do we go?
Dovzhenko stood and looked at her, dumbfounded. Honestly, I am not sure. I cannot go back. That is certain.
Because you can be associated with Mariam. Dovzhenko nodded.
I knew Mariam better than anyone. You told me enough of the story that I can read between the lines, Isabel said. They have evidence that you two were together the night she was murdered?
They will, Dovzhenko whispered, soon enough.
Isabel bowed her head for a moment and then looked heavenward, eyes clenched shut, coming to some painful conclusion. She heaved a heavy sigh.
Listen to me. Mariam spoke to me several times of a mysterious gentleman friend. I have had just such a friend in the past who was, shall we say, in your line of work, so I know something about it. What's more, I'm smart enough to know that if you are a Russian operative assigned to assist the Revolutionary Guard, your coming here will be viewed by your superiors in Moscow as a gross dereliction of duty, if not treason.
Dovzhenko closed his eyes. That is true.
So, Isabel said, you are running too.
I am.
So you wish to defect to the West?
I am so exhausted.
She gave a musing nod. I take that to mean yes.
Isabel leaned against the wall, lips slightly pursed, eyes narrowed in thought. Stress and sadness caused her face to flush as if she were sunburnt, making the pale scars on her face and neck contrast more than usual. Dovzhenko couldn't help but wonder about the corresponding psychological wounds. He glanced at the Vostok on his wrist. He'd been here less than 10 minutes. She would need time to process, but they had to move.
Isabel groaned, seeming to come to some decision. You risked a lot coming to warn me. I am grateful for that. You cannot go back to Russia, and you certainly cannot return to Iran.
He could ask the Italians for asylum, Hamid said. They are the ones running NATO forces for now.
Whatever I do, Dovzhenko said, I would prefer to do it from somewhere else, if only to avoid any of Redbeard's friends.
At last you speak some sense, Hamid said. The two men followed Isabel into the front office, where she retrieved a small day pack.
She draped the scarf over her head in preparation to go outside, and then stopped to stare Dovzhenko directly in the face, as if looking at the back of his skull. "Do you just want to run, or would you turn?" Turn? He knew exactly what she meant, but wondered if she did. Yes, turn. Flip, defect, provide your specific knowledge of what is going on inside the IRGC and Iranian politics to your counterparts in the West. A cold chill washed over Dovzhenko. The woman spoke not as an aid worker trying to stanch the flow of opium from Afghanistan to Iran, but as one who was intimately familiar with the ways of intelligence services. The scars suddenly made much more sense. Dovzhenko spoke deliberately. "As you might imagine, in my line of work it is extremely difficult to know whom I can trust." "That is true in any line of work," Isabel corrected, "at least in things that matter. I know someone who can help us both. He's kind of a har," she said, "but I'm 100% certain that he is a donkey we can trust. I will call him on the way." 100 meters down the street from the yellow building that served as the UNODC office, a Pashtun man lay on the rooftop of a nondescript mud building, rendered almost invisible by the blowing dust. He wore the loose shalwar kameez. A flat pakol hat was pulled down over his brow, held in place with a gray headscarf against the wind. He had no idea exactly how old he was, but he guessed it was somewhere around 50. Dark, wind-battered features made him appear well over 60, but with the muscle and stamina of a man who walked for miles back and forth across the border with Iran, accustomed to much discomfort and heavy lifting. A pair of Soviet-era binoculars pressed against his eyes. He'd not yet made the pilgrimage to Mecca and could not claim the wisdom of the gray, so his scabby beard was dyed orange-red. He was, however, wise enough to know that this new man visiting the Iranian bitch carried himself like a Russian. Years of infidel occupation laid bare the subtle differences in the way Russians and Americans carried themselves. Russians acted as if they owned the world. The Americans simply owned it. He watched the Iranian woman's bodyguard come out and retrieve the old van and drive it up in front of the building, obscuring the view of the door. A small radio with a whip antenna crackled at the Afghan's elbow. "Shall we take them now?" "Hold," the Afghan said. He hadn't survived these decades as a smuggler by rushing into things. They'd come to take the woman, but the Russian added a new dimension. An alternative plan began to form in his mind. It would be lucrative, but it would take some time to set up. This Russian had somehow bested the two men he'd sent inside to take the woman. He could not be underestimated. The Iranian woman was a thorn in everybody's shoe. She stirred up trouble with opium producers, made the other women believe they deserved more than they were already given, and walked around a good deal of the time with her hijab cocked to expose half of her head. She was not just a whore, but a meddlesome whore. The Afghan would make double the profit, earning from one side to get rid of her and the others who bought her for their pleasure, or to sell again. His tongue flicked out of her dusty lips, thinking of all the money. The woman and the Russian came out next, and the van pulled away. "They are leaving," the voice on the radio hissed. "Follow them," the Afghan said. "See where they go. We have much to do." A motorcycle on the street below coughed to life, followed by another. They both rolled out of the alley farther down the street and rode into the cloud of dust after the taillights of Isabel Kashani's van. Chapter 38. "What?" Ding Chavez lowered his reading glasses when Jack walked into Clark's hotel room. "You look like you took a snap kick to the walnuts." Ryan made his way to the couch to flop down, only to pop up again and grab a bottle of water from the minibar. The Russians had gone, so the room at the Eme Cathedral now served as the command post, allowing team members to meet and plan while slowing their op-tempo and rotating surveillance on Dahosha. At present, Adara was taking a nap, while Caruso and Midas were in the lobby of the Alfonso XIII. They'd sing out if Dahosha or Fournier left the hotel. "Seriously, kid," Clark asked, "are you getting sick?" Ryan exhaled quickly and then took a long drink of water, wiping his mouth with his forearm before blurting, "Isabel Kashani." His eyes had a thousand-yard stare, as if looking through the wall instead of at it, fixed on nothing. Clark shot a glance at Ding, then back at Ryan. "What about her?"
"She's in trouble, John."
"In London?" Ryan shook his head.
"Her Facebook profile shows her in London with a husband and baby, but she's too smart to post photos of her family online. That was all cover. She's in Afghanistan, and she's in trouble."
"Damn," Chavez said when Ryan finished recounting Kashani's phone call.
"You believe her?"
"Of course I believe her," Jack said, incredulous. "She knows what we do. Hell, she saved my life."
"Believe was the wrong choice of word, Mano," Chavez said. "What I meant was, is she sure this guy is a Russian spook?"
"If anyone would know, it would be her," Jack said. "She was writing opinion papers on Russia for the university when I met her."
Clark rubbed his chin in thought.
"If this Russian wants to turn, he should just go to the embassy in Kabul. The agency has plenty of competent case officers there who can deal with him."
"It sounds like he has some trust issues," Ryan said. "He trusts her and she trusts me. She's hoping I'll handle it personally."
"Oh, hell no," Chavez said. "That's too classic. We don't let Oppo choose who their handler is going to be. Besides, CIA would get more than a little pissy if we jump into the middle of their bailiwick."
"We're already in the middle of it, Ding," Ryan said, pleading his case. "She called me."
Chavez scoffed, mimicking the tone of an answering machine.
"Beep. If this call is in reference to a defection, please hang up and dial 1-800-CIA or go to your nearest U.S. embassy."
Ryan waved him off and turned to Clark. "John, this Russian has been inside Iran for months. He could be a treasure trove of information. You know as well as I do how hard it is to work assets in that country."
Clark looked at Ding. "Can you give us a minute?"
Chavez shrugged, staring for a long moment at Ryan.
"I'll go check on the others while you talk some sense into numbnuts."
"I should have known better when I first saw her Facebook page," Jack said, as soon as Chavez was gone and the door shut.
"So," Clark said, "she's not married?"
Several months before, Jack had taken a peek at Isabel's Facebook page to find a photo of her with a man and a baby, looking happily married and living in London. He now kicked himself for taking anything on social media at face value.
"No husband," he said, "and no baby. She couldn't talk about it much on the phone, but it makes sense. Hell, everyone I know in this business has a fake profile on social media. I was using one when I looked at hers."
"Listen, no," Clark said. "Do yourself a favor and you listen before you run off half-cocked. I know you feel like you owe this girl for putting her in harm's way."
"They beat the hell out of her, John. Broke her neck trying to get to me. She healed, but that's a little more than harm's way, don't you think?"
"My point," Clark said, his voice even, "is that you feel responsible for things that were out of your control. The government of Iran has done some serious backsliding in the Freedom Department since you were over there last. The mullahs are clinging to power tighter than ever, fighting for the very existence of their regime with everything they've got. No one knows who's aligned with who anymore. It's not much of a leap to make the case that someone who felt he owed Kashani, who'd been her lover no less, might be blind to the possibility of a trap."
Jack was silent for nearly a full minute, steadying his feet. The tension of the moment caused him to breathe as if he'd just sprinted up a flight of stairs. At length, he looked up, jaw set with a realization he didn't like.
"I can't argue with you."
"Good," Clark said, "because if you had, I wouldn't have let you go." Jack's mouth fell open.
"You're going to authorize it?"
"Jack," Clark said, and sighed.
The mere fact that you came in here and informed me of the call before you just hopped on a plane is light years ahead of where you were when you and Isabel were together. I don't like splitting the team, but for all we know, Dehosha could sit here in Seville for another month. You said your